Welcome to the Goat Rodeo Podcast. I'm your host, Garrett Smith, joined by fellow co-hosts, Simon Kuhn and Dave Cottle. We work at Reveal. We like talking about geopolitics at the crossroads of defense technology and venture capital and the innovation economy and everything in between. I'm looking at the docket. I'm looking at the list of topics that we're going to be covering today, and I see El Paso is number one.
So excited about topic one. This is the most important part of the day.
Take it away.
I'm gonna do the lead in because I don't think anyone actually knows all the facts, and we're gonna try to sort them out live here on the Goat Rodeo.
But this is what we do.
It's a public service on the news.
It's a public service we provide.
Exactly. Yeah. A border patrol operated Locust system, which is a high energy laser developed by Blue Halo, acquired by AeroVironment, shot down a birthday balloon, which then led to a 10-day shutdown of the El Paso airport, which was then immediately turned into, I think it was a couple of hours that it was actually shut down in real time, which leads to so many questions about our integrated air defense or purchase of high-energy laser weapon systems, whether or not we need to put missiles on the border. And then let's not forget, that's a system operated by an arm of the government that is now shut down due to lack of funding. Dave, I really want to hear your first thoughts on this because, as the resident Army man, I know you have thoughts on integrated air defense systems, and I want to tell you why they're bad thoughts, but I want to hear the thoughts first.
Well, they put the system down there for a reason.
And allegedly.
I think the details are unclear there, but there were alleged incursions by presumably cartels.
That's a vehicle-mounted system, I believe. I'm pretty sure the Locust is on top of like a Humvee.
I think it's got wheels.
Right,
yeah. It's got wheels. I think it's got wheels.
So it's not a permanent installation that was put there a year ago and it's just been sitting there. They drove it there intentionally, presumably recently.
Right. Based off of some perceived threat.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem here, my take is, we took a U.S. military high energy laser weapon that doesn't talk to or work with any of the other domestic things.
Mm-hmm.
Is not like FAA compliant CONOPS. Mm-hmm. And we threw it at this problem. So
it knocked out a kid's balloon.
So the mini IADs, like there has to be a southern border oriented counter UAS capability that is more sensitive, that's a layered approach. Like I just don't it has to be layered, it has to be fused track, it has to be like clear command control with graduated response options, and it's gotta work with all of our other stuff on a domestic CONOP. So this is how we do standard air defense.
Yeah, well, that's how the military does standard air defense. But I have to wonder, is there a single airport in America with a system of any kind that can be turned on, whether it's kinetic or laser, and the whole airport and the whole city won't freak out? Is there anywhere where I can shoot a rocket from just outside the fence line of an airport and not cause 500,000 people to go, what the fuck? They're shooting rockets at the airport. Like, I don't know that you can ever make a system that's that well publicized to not make the public panic. Like it feels like an impossible task. You'd have to put advertisements at every bus stop at the airport for a decade before people were even casually aware that there could be rockets fired off to take out drones, or in this case it's a laser, it's invisible. It should have been the least like alarm causing thing, aside from the fact that it killed somebody's balloon.
But the alternative is without graduated response options. Like without any response options of any kind, the airports are going to get shut down. Like this is not going to get better. It's going to get worse.
So here's my follow-up complaint to that. You got to have graduated response options because of the perceived threat. It's like that's why? Because right now all we've shut down is a balloon and no one has articulated. I have friends that care a lot about cartel activity and the southern border and people who are very educated on this thing. So I am a slightly more educated than average individual.
You have friends on which side? On which side, Simon?
Yeah, I have lots of cartel friends. This is now graduated from having communist friends to having narco-terrorist cartel friends.
No, they could still be communists, though. Maybe that's the commonality, right?
That only people like yourself would assume that they're all they have commonalities between the arch capitalists of narco-terrorism, who are very money-motivated and are not big on sharing the means of production. But anyway, the point that I was trying to make.
Hey, dude,
is...
you got to fund the revolution somehow, Simon. You gotta...
yeah, strange bedfellows, right? That's exactly why we fund ISIS. Now, moving on from that topic, my question becomes, you have to have some level of public education around what this threat actually is, particularly when your only successful strike to date, again, is a birthday balloon. You have to figure out how to make people understand this is a political activity. War is a political activity. It's not a technocrat vacuum where we get to like apply our craft and be like, oh, we're successful, so it doesn't matter. Like, no, we have to justify constantly.
Sure. And I'm not making the assertion that cartels, I mean, it's not good for cartel business for them to strike an airport.
Right.
The point is like, we can't allow a littoral open air corridor.
Yeah.
On any of our borders. Like we have to be able to detect, track, and interdict.
But we do need to keep in mind, I don't disagree with your base premise, which is that we do need integrated air defense systems that can talk and that are coordinated with civilian agencies.
Sorry, you do or you do not agree?
I do agree.
Yeah, of course.
But what I'm trying to highlight is that is not the whole conversation. That's probably the easiest third of the conversation. The hard part of the conversation is making the civilians understand so that when you shoot the laser that has definitely been there for some time, right? Like the LOCUST system is not brand new. It took a lot of time, I'm sure, for CBP to find the resources and deploy that thing. So it didn't just like appear in the El Paso area recently out of thin air. And it still caused the airport to go, oh no, we just shut down for 10 days. Like they freaked.
So apparently in January or February, I'm just looking at some news here, there was a transfer of the military grade laser technology from DOD, I think via the Joint Interagency Task Force Counter Cartel, JIATF-CC, which I think is a thing. Yeah. I'm not sure if that's part of JIATF North or if it's something.
Fair,
I don't know what.
Right, new admin.
So they transferred the laser weapon technology to CBP. So I don't think the CBP found the money somewhere. This is a military piece of hardware that was transferred to CBP for their use along the border in a counter cartel mission.
I think that reinforces my point, right? The easy one third is moving this equipment into place and transferring it amongst the entities designed to defend the border and the homeland. The hard part is making the community aware and understand and be prepared for, hey, we might have to shoot drones down sooner rather than later. This is real and this is on your, like, we're not really doing any of that work, it doesn't feel like.
I don't know. DHS cut one of the fastest contracts they ever have for counter UAS type solutions. I mean, historically DHS moves really slow, and whatever's happened, you know, transpired on the southern border with cartels and the UAS over the last 6 months, got them moving, procuring things, testing things, and buying things. So like at least the Department of Homeland Security recognizes there is some credible threat with time pressure.
We'll see. I mean, we'll see. So let's transition topics to recent activities with Canada.
Our other neighbor,
yeah, neighbor of the north,
Mark. Yeah, so Mark Carney, I think the current prime minister.
Yes,
some of the current announced Canada's first ever defense industrial strategy, or I think it's their first ever, which is a multi-billion-dollar investment that they signed up for defense procurement and industrial capacity building, which intends to trend them towards their historically sort of underspent 2% goal. And this is particularly intriguing to me because we have a team in Canada right now, and that team is responding to the frequency and urgency of technology or capability orders has increased from Canada. They've been a great customer for defense capabilities, but their urgency and frequency by which they're procuring things has increased dramatically.
Yeah, you know, I think there's two headlines here, right? Which is a lot more Canadian defense spending, but just as big is the buy Canadian mandate. Right? Like we're seeing not only this desire to spend money, but very aggressively and explicitly, they want to buy Canadian stuff now. That's what the politicals are saying.
I think it's kind of funny that the Europeans, the Canadians, and others are acting like seriously aggrieved when the United States kind of forces them in some ways to stand up and provide for their own defense and, like, you know, onshore or reshore a bunch of the defense industrial base for those places. They kind of behave a little bit like aggrieved victims when in fact they are sovereign nations that should be responsible for their own security at some level, right? And I'm not saying that the Trump administration is right in every regard here. I'm not saying that this particular kind of strategy that we seem to be wending as a country is correct or fully correct or even partially correct. I'm just identifying that these are sovereign nations. Grow up, you know, like good for you, Canada. Like join the community of adult nations.
I think that slightly underplays the value proposition that America has sold its allies for decades, literally post-World War II. The promise was that we were going to do the majority of this. So there is, like, let's not pretend there isn't a course correction happening.
Hold on, though. Just purely on NATO requirements or commitments for, you know, percentage of GDP defense spend, most nations never lived up to that. The United States is one of the very few countries in the collection of 28 or 30 that has ever really consistently lived up to the spending, you know, commitment. And so, like, I don't have a ton of sympathy, except to say that if the United States really does intend to remain a viable global, you know, superpower of one, then I think the United States should be on the hook for, you know, throwing its weight around to be a, you know, a world policeman, in other words.
Yeah, I mean, I think that without crunching the numbers, the U.S. has certainly been the leading proponent of international intervention in the post-NATO world. So that comes with a certain amount of responsibility as well. Like, yeah, we're the one who's always raising the alarm bell of everybody get off your ass. We're going to X, Y, or Z country. I'm not surprised at all to find that we were footing the majority of that bill. But I do, like, I agree with your overarching point, though, which is, how do you push back against bandwagoning activity? This is not a new, like, set of challenges. This is the problem of alliances always and forever. The reason members of the alliance don't pull their weight is because one of them is pulling more weight than everybody else, which means we also need to internalize, like, as we pull less weight, they will pull more and they will have a bigger say in what happens. We're no longer going to be able to lead it around by the nose if we're no longer, you know, spending the most and leading the charge all the time.
I do think that it's encouraging that the Canadians are finally this year on track to meet the 2% of GDP, you know, NATO spending threshold. $6.6 billion defense industrial base reinvestment strategy. Just compare that against the $1.5 trillion that Trump wants to spend in the United States. Good. I'm glad Canada's doing this. I really am. I truly am. And I'm sorry to poke fun. I'm gratified that Prime Minister Carney has indicated that sometime around 2035 they might meet the 5% threshold. So good yeah. For you, Canada. Good for you.
I think the irony is that despite everyone cranking up their 2%, America will actually not lessen its burden on defense spending. It's going to increase its defense spending by 50%.
Sure.
You know,
you have to, if you have to be able to afford American made stuff, you got to ramp up the spending, sure, right?
Yeah. There's another one on this thread, Japan, it's got, you know, reveal employees, traveling around the globe. Japan is heating up as well in a similar way. I don't think it's exactly the same as Canada, but Canada is looking to build out its industrial base homegrown. Japan has more of a, like, temporal existential threat looming, and doesn't necessarily intend to grow their organic industrial base, but they are very serious. And Japan seems to be one of the few places right now that's both increasing their defense budget, rewriting policy or modernizing their policy and procurement. And that's it's heating up in Japan.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we for one are taking it very seriously.
Right. Because Japan, who already spends more on defense, is also committing to spend even more, but with, as far as I can tell, almost no sovereign, it must be built domestically, guardrails, unless you guys have seen otherwise.
No, I haven't. And that kind of makes sense. They're an import economy, right? They don't have a lot of domestic, you know, natural resources. They have to go off island, in other words, to to procure.
And I think that urgency.
I do think that that's one of the few alliance structures that has not been stressed or put under stress by the Trump administration. I think that is that's an economy and a nation with a kind of a retooling defense apparatus that is definitively on the front lines with China, our main kind of competitor, especially in Bridge Colby's world, the only one that matters. And they've been retooling the defense force to be, you know, more of a force projection type military over the past many years. So I think that in terms of reading the trend lines, you know, comparing Japan with NATO countries that were much more kind of like low spending, America reliant, the Japanese have been retooling in the way that I think the Trump administration would have preferred they do for many, many, many years. So I think they've just kind of like been on the same track. They've been on the same wavelength for a while. Hence, they're not coming under the same kind of direct stress from the Trump administration that other nations are. And again, they're on the front lines, right? This is the first island chain right off the China coastline. So I think they are feeling it, the urgency, in a way that other nations just for some reason aren't. You know, I don't really get the NATO thing. Russia's right there and is actively attacking a neighboring country. So I don't really understand why there isn't more urgency in NATO. But yeah, that's the European Union. That's the European Commission. Okay. Should we talk AppFit? I think AppFit's a big item kind of on a lot of defense technology companies' radar. I think it's been in receipt of an increased mandate, scope, and budget. It's an important kind of way to accelerate adoption, especially in off years before the palming process delivers budget and resources to new innovative adoptions within the programs managed by the department. What's on your radar for the AppFit program, Dave?
Yeah, so they've expanded the program, more budget, more twice a year, you know, big awards. I think it's somewhere between, you know, $20 and $50 million type awards to, you know, launch across that sort of valley of death situation. The acronym is Accelerate the Procurement and Fielding of Innovative Technologies. So this is an OSD R&E program that's been, I think, pretty successful, or at least perceived to be successful. The big news on AppFit is they've now opened it up for software solutions, which has not been the case previously. It had to be a, you know, hardware type capability. They weren't doing, you know, procuring software licenses or investing in software development. That's changed. This open cycle of AppFits right now has $75 million set aside for either the procurement of software licenses or the development or finishing of relatively mature software solutions. And that's interesting to a whole variety of like software vendors and VC-backed software startup type folks. It's also really interesting to, you know, all of the program managers across the DoD that have had a pet project or a software capability that they thought provided a lot of value. It's their opportunity to put in a submission to OSD and ask for meaningful funding to move really quickly to get that software in the field, which is super interesting. So I expect it to be one of the most contested pools of $75 million in the history of, in the recent memory of defense acquisition.
Some data here I pulled up. Since the program inception in 2022, the AppFit program has pushed out $1.4 billion in total awards. It's a lot of money. And every single one of those went to non-traditional defense contracts, so firms that have not exceeded $400 million in DoD obligations in a previous year. It's procurement funds. It's not RDT&E. So that's an important kind of bridging the valley of death moment for a lot of young companies that are trying to breach into this market. And companies don't apply, just to dispel some rumors and myths. If any of our listeners are young companies and they think, I should go get me some AppFit money, well, you cannot directly apply. Your customers or target customers have to request those funds. It then goes through kind of a filtering and vetting process and a decision board at OSD level. And I think, am I right, Dave, that the services nominate their top 1, 2, 3 programs or requests, and then those get the preponderance of available funding, right? Is that how it works?
Yeah, so the application is done by something that looks like a program management office or a combatant command. They're filtered up either to a combatant command or to the service. Each service, each combatant command has an allotted number of submissions, around 3-ish, depending on the command, that then get reviewed at the OSD level. The important thing that I think a lot of folks miss is not just that the government customer has to request this funding so that they can spend it on their efforts, their programs, their requirements. It's also that that program office that's doing the submission and asking for the funding prove the sustainment and life cycle of that program over time. So they have to say, hey, I need this budget to get started or to move quickly or to bridge the gap between what I knew I needed 2 years ago when I asked for my budget and what I need today. But they have to prove with their own budget that they can service this work in the out year. So that it doesn't just be that, you know, the Office of the Secretary of Defense grants them the money, they buy a thing, and then it sort of dies on the vine, which I thought was a really good design.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, many of our congressional counterparts, if they're going to engage in any kind of appropriating activity, prefer that there is a transition pathway so that, a program office that benefits from a directed appropriation, as an example, defines and defends a long-term, programming and budgeting plan that allows for future year adoption so that it's not, continually going back to the APFIT or to the congressional appropriation trough for money, and that the services take care of themselves if they really care or think that the program is worth maintaining. You mentioned software. I think most APFIT awards to date have been kind of hardware centric, buying every single one. Yeah.
This is, strictly speaking, a separate pipe. This is a pilot to do software. So some of the rules you described for APFIT don't apply here, where traditionally all APFITs are procurement only. There's about $325 million for FY26 for traditional procurement APFITs. This is a $75 million set aside for specifically 6.8 RDT&E funding. 6.8 is a very late stage RDT&E funding line. But you can also use it as procurement dollars, which is pretty interesting, but you can't mix them. But I think what's really important here is this is a pilot. This is not, APFIT will be administering this pilot, the APFIT program at OUSD, the Office of Secretary of Defense, but it is not the traditional APFIT pot of money. So it could go really well, and maybe we see it like get opened up. But I think to Dave's biggest concern is like, this is going to be a very contested $75 million pot of money because software companies cannot go after the bigger pot of $325 million. They have to stay inside of these pilot rules of submission. Yeah.
Well, if it's a pilot, does that mean that they intend to expand in future APFIT years, provided the pilot performs? I'm expecting, just the way that any government program, when it succeeds or hits the metrics, like it always gets plussed up, right? Even if it's...
I would imagine it's not a plus up, though. It's just incorporation into the APFIT pot of money, right? You've already got a big APFIT pot of money. They're just scared to let software guys come in and steal all of that money. So I think what they're really testing is the guardrails that they apply on software with a special little pot.
And it may be hard to measure success here, honestly.
But yeah.
Well, gents, this was intended to be a rapid fire, short form Goat Rodeo podcast. I think we're going to deliver that. I've got a hard stop here in a moment. I will just say, Simon Kuhn and I and many of our Reveal cohort are heading out to Palm Springs this weekend to attend the Creative Disruptors in the Desert event, which occurs on an annual basis. And it's going to be a good time. Lots of senior DOW folks and congressionals and thought leaders and investors and young companies like ours out there to change the trajectory of defense innovation and defense innovation uptake. Simon, any notes ahead of jumping on a plane, going to Palm Springs? The weather does not look good, by the way.
I haven't looked. I'm just going to hope for the best. I'd like to do all this with just a childlike sense of wonder and a notebook and just see what happens. So I think it's going to be great. It was great last year. I'm looking forward to it this year.
Yeah. I've noticed that you wander around some of these event halls with a childlike sense of wonder on your face.
Targets of opportunity is probably another way to describe it.
It's going to be a good event, and we will report back next week. Thanks, everybody. Sorry for a short form quick burst, but we'll be back next week with more snark and banter, and wish you all well. Adios.